One of the worst fallacies in the field of economics, propagated by Karl Marx and accepted by almost everyone today, including many businessmen, is the notion that the development of monopolies is an inescapable and intrinsic result of the operation of a free, unregulated economy. In fact, the exact opposite is true. It is a free market that makes monopolies impossible. It is imperative that we be clear and specific in our definition of monopoly. When people speak in an economic or political context of the dangers and evils of monopoly, what they mean, quite clearly, is a coercive monopoly. That is, exclusive control of a given field of production which is closed to and exempt from competition, so that those controlling the field are able to set arbitrary production policies and charge arbitrary prices, independent of the market, immune from the law of supply and demand. Such a monopoly, it is important to note, entails more than the absence of competition. It entails the impossibility of competition. That is a coercive monopoly's characteristic attribute, which is essential to any condemnation of such a monopoly. In the entire history of capitalism, no one has been able to establish a coercive monopoly by means of competition on a free market. There is only one way to forbid entry into a given field of production: by law. Every coercive monopoly that exists or has ever existed in the United States, in Europe, or anywhere else in the world, was created and made possible only by an act of government, by special franchises, licenses, subsidies, by legislative actions which granted special privileges not obtainable on a free market to a man or a group of men and forbade all others to enter that particular field. A coercive monopoly is not the result of laissez-faire. It can result only from the abrogation of laissez-faire and from the introduction of the opposite principle, the principle of statism. In this country, a utility company is a coercive monopoly. The government grants it a franchise for an exclusive territory, and no one else is allowed to engage in that service in that territory. A would-be competitor attempting to sell electric power would be stopped by law. A telephone company is a coercive monopoly. As recently as World War II, the government ordered the two then existing telegraph companies, Western Union and Postal Telegraph, to merge into one monopoly. In the comparatively free days of American capitalism, in the late 19th, early 20th century, there were many attempts to corner the market on various commodities, such as cotton and wheat, to mention two famous examples, then close the field to competition and gather huge profits by selling at exorbitant prices. All such attempts failed. The men who tried it were compelled to give up or else go bankrupt. They were defeated not by legislative action, but by the action of the free market. The question is often asked, what if a large, rich company kept buying out its smaller competitors or kept forcing them out of business by means of undercutting prices and selling at a loss? Would it not be able to gain control of a given field and then start charging high prices and be free to stagnate with no fear of competition? The answer is no, it could not be done. If a company assumed heavy losses in order to drive out competitors, then began to charge high prices to regain what it had lost, this would necessarily serve as an incentive for new competitors to enter the field and take advantage of the high profitability without any losses to recoup. The new competitors would force prices down to the market level. The large company would have to abandon its attempt to establish monopoly prices or go bankrupt, fighting off the competitors that its own policies would attract. It is a matter of historical fact that no price war has ever succeeded in establishing a monopoly or in maintaining prices above the market level outside the law of supply and demand. Price wars have, however, acted as spurs to the economic efficiency of competing companies and have thereby resulted in enormous benefits to the public in terms of better products at lower prices. In considering this issue, people frequently ignore the crucial role of the capital market in a free economy. As Alan Greenspan observes in his article, Antitrust, which appears in Ayn Rand's book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, as Mr. Greenspan observes, if entry into a given field of production is not impeded by government regulations, franchises, or subsidies, then, quoting Mr. Greenspan, quote, the ultimate regulator of the competition in a free economy is the capital market. So long as capital is free to flow, it will tend to seek those areas which offer the maximum rate of return, unquote. Investors are constantly seeking the most profitable uses of their capital. If, therefore, some field of production is seen to be highly profitable, particularly when the profitability is due to high prices rather than to low costs, businessmen and investors necessarily will be attracted to that field. And as the supply of the product in question is increased relative to the demand for it, prices fall accordingly. Again, quoting Mr. Greenspan, quote, the capital market acts as a regulator of prices, not necessarily of profits. It leaves an individual producer free to earn as much as he can by lowering his costs and by increasing his efficiency relative to others. Thus, it constitutes the mechanism that generates greater incentives to increase productivity and leads, as a consequence, to a rising standard of living. Close quote. The free market does not permit inefficiency or stagnation with economic impunity in any field of production. Consider, for instance, a well-known incident in the history of the American automobile industry. There was a period when Henry Ford's Model T held an enormous part of the automobile market. But when Ford's company attempted to stagnate and to resist stylistic changes, you have doubtless all heard the famous slogan attributed to Ford, you can have any color of the Model T you want so long as it's black. General Motors, with its more attractively styled Chevrolet, cut into a major segment of Ford's market, and the Ford company was compelled to change its policies in order to compete. One will find examples of this principle in the history of virtually every industry. Now, if one considers the only kind of monopoly that can exist under capitalism, a non-coercive monopoly, one will see that its prices and production policies are not independent of the wider market in which it operates, but are fully bound by the law of supply and demand. That there is no particular reason for or value in retaining the designation of monopoly when one uses it in a non-coercive sense, and that there are no rational grounds on which to condemn such monopolies, in quotes. For instance, if a small town has only one drugstore, which is barely able to survive, the owner might be described as enjoying a monopoly, except, of course, that no one would think of using the term in this context. There is no economic need or market for a second drugstore. There is not enough trade to support it. But if that town grew, its one drugstore would have no way, no power, to prevent other drugstores from being opened. It is often thought that the field of mining is particularly vulnerable to the establishment of monopolies, since the materials extracted from the earth exist in limited quantity, and since it is believed some firm might gain control of all the sources of some raw material. But observe, for example, that International Nickel of Canada produces more than two-thirds of the world's nickel, yet it does not charge monopoly prices. It prices its product as though it had a great many competitors. And the truth is that it does have a great many competitors. Nickel, in the form of alloy and stainless steels, is competing with aluminum and a variety of other materials. The seldom recognized principle involved in such cases is that no single product, commodity, or material is or can be indispensable to an economy regardless of price. A commodity can be only relatively preferable to other commodities. For example, when the price of bituminous coal rose, which incidentally was due to John L. Lewis forcing an economically unjustified wage raise, this was instrumental in bringing about a large-scale conversion to the use of oil and gas in many industries. The free market is its own protector. Now, if a company were able to gain and hold a non-coercive monopoly, if it were able to win all the customers in a given field, not by special government-granted privileges, but by sheer productive efficiency, by its ability to keep its costs low and/or to offer a better product than any competitor could, there would be no grounds on which to condemn such a monopoly. On the contrary, the company that achieved it would deserve the highest praise and esteem. No one can morally claim the right to compete in a given field if he cannot match the productive efficiency of those with whom he hopes to compete. There is no reason why people should buy inferior products at higher prices in order to maintain less efficient companies in business. Under capitalism, any man or company that can surpass competitors is free to do so. It is in this manner that the free market rewards ability and works for the benefit of everyone, except those who seek the undeserved. A bromide commonly cited in this connection by capitalism's opponents is the story of the old corner grocer who is driven out of business by the big chain store. What is the clear implication of their protest when they cite this sort of example? It is that the people who live in the neighborhood of the old grocer have to continue buying from him, even though a chain store could give them better service at lower prices and thereby let them save money. Thus, both the owners of the chain store and the people in the neighborhood are to be penalized in order to protect the stagnation of the old grocer. By what right? If that grocer is unable to compete with the chain store, then properly he has no choice but to move elsewhere or go into another line of business or perhaps seek employment from the chain store. Capitalism, by its nature, entails a constant process of motion, of growth, of progress. No one has a vested right to a position if others can do better than he can. When people denounce the free market as cruel, the fact they are decrying is that the market is ruled by a single moral principle, justice. And that is the root of their hatred for capitalism. There is only one kind of monopoly that men may rightfully condemn, the only kind for which the designation of monopoly is economically significant, a coercive monopoly. Observe that in the non-coercive meaning of the term, every man may be described as a monopolist, since he is the exclusive owner of his effort and product. But this is not regarded as evil, except, of course, by socialists. In the issue of monopolies, as in so many other issues, capitalism is commonly blamed for the evils perpetrated by its destroyers. It is not free trade on a free market that creates coercive monopolies, but government legislation, government action, government controls. If men are concerned about the evils of monopolies, let them identify the actual villain in the picture and the actual cause of the evils, government intervention into the economy. Let them recognize that there is only one way to destroy monopolies, by the separation of state and economics. That is, by instituting the principle that the government may not abridge the freedom of production and trade. One of the most widespread delusions of our age is the belief that the American worker owes his high standard of living to unions and to humanitarian labor legislation. This belief is contradicted by the most fundamental facts and principles of economics, facts and principles which are systematically evaded by labor leaders, legislators, and intellectuals of the statist persuasion. A country's standard of living, including the wages of its workers, depends on the productivity of labor. High productivity depends on machines, inventions, and capital investment, which depend on the creative ingenuity of individual men, which requires, for its exercise, a politico-economic system that protects the individual's rights and freedom. The productive value of physical labor as such is low. If the worker of today produces more than the worker of 50 years ago, it is not because the former exerts more physical effort. Quite the contrary. The physical effort required of him is far less. The productive value of his effort has been multiplied many times by the tools and machines with which he works. They are crucial in determining the economic worth of his services. To illustrate this principle, consider what would be a man's economic reward on the desert island for pushing his finger the distance of half an inch. Then consider the wages paid for pushing a button to an elevator operator in New York City. It is not muscles that make the difference. As the distinguished economist Professor Ludwig von Mises observes in his book entitled Planning for Freedom, quote, American wages are higher than wages in other countries because the capital invested per head of the worker is greater and the plants are thereby in the position to use the most efficient tools and machines. What is called the American way of life is the result of the fact that the United States has put fewer obstacles in the way of saving and capital accumulation than other nations. The economic backwardness of such countries as India consists precisely in the fact that their policies hinder both the accumulation of capital and the investment of foreign capital. As the capital required is lacking, the Indian enterprises are prevented from employing sufficient quantities of modern equipment, and therefore producing much less per man hour, and can only afford to pay wage rates, which, compared with American wage rates, appear as shockingly low. Close quote. In a free market economy, employers must bid competitively for the services of workers, just as they must bid competitively for all the other factors of production. If an employer attempts to pay wages which are lower than his workers can obtain elsewhere, he will lose his workers and thus will be compelled to change his policy or go out of business. If, other things being equal, an employer pays wages which are above the market level, his higher costs will put him at a competitive disadvantage in the sale of his products, and again he will be compelled to change his policy or go out of business. Employers do not lower wages because they are cruel, nor raise wages because they are kind. Wages are not determined by the employer's whim. Wages are the prices paid for human labor, and like all other prices in a free economy, are determined by the law of supply and demand. Since the start of the Industrial Revolution and capitalism, wage rates have risen steadily. As an inevitable economic consequence of rising capital accumulation, technological progress, and industrial expansion. As capitalism created countless new markets, so it created an ever-widening market for labor. It multiplied the number and kinds of jobs available, increased the demand and competition for the worker services, and thus drove wage rates upward. It was the economic self-interest of employers that led them to raise wages and shorten working hours, not the pressure of labor unions. The 8-hour day was established in most American industries long before unions acquired any significant size or economic power. At a time when his competitors were paying their workers between $2 and $3 a day, Henry Ford offered $5 a day, thereby attracting the most efficient labor force in the country and thus raising his own production and profits. In the 1920s, when the labor movement in France and Germany was far more dominant than in the United States, the standard of living of the American worker was greatly superior. It was the consequence of economic freedom. Needless to say, men have a right to organize into unions, provided they do so voluntarily. That is, provided no one is forced to join. Unions can have value as fraternal organizations, or as a means of keeping members informed of current market conditions, or as a means of bargaining more effectively with employers, particularly in small, isolated communities. It may happen that an individual employer is paying wages that, in the overall market context, are too low. In this case, a strike or the threat of a strike can compel him to change his policy, since he will discover that he cannot obtain an adequate labor force at the wages he offers. However, the belief that unions can cause a general rise in the standard of living is a myth. Today, the labor market is no longer free. Far from it. Unions enjoy a unique, near-monopolistic power over many aspects of the economy. This has been achieved through legislation which has forced men to join unions, whether they wish to or not, and forced employers to deal with these unions, whether they wish to or not. As a consequence, wage rates in many industries are no longer determined by a free market. Unions have been able to force wages substantially above their normal market level. These are the alleged social gains for which unions are usually given credit. In fact, however, the result of their policy has been A, curtailment of production, B, widespread unemployment, and C, the penalizing of workers in other industries as well as the rest of the population. Let us consider these points. A, with the rise of wage rates to inordinately high levels, production costs are such that cutbacks in production are often necessary. New undertakings become too expensive and growth is hindered. At the increased costs, marginal producers, that is, those who have been barely able to compete in the market, find themselves unable to remain in business. The overall result? Goods and services that would have been produced are not brought into existence. B, as a result of the high wage rates, employers can afford to hire fewer workers. As a result of curtailed production, employers need fewer workers. Thus, one group of workers obtains unjustifiably high wages at the expense of other workers who are unable to find jobs at all. This, in conjunction with minimum wage laws is the cause of widespread unemployment. Unemployment is the inevitable result of forcing wage rates above their free market level. In a free economy in which neither employers nor workers are subject to coercion, wage rates always tend toward the level at which all those who seek employment will be able to obtain it. In a frozen, controlled economy, this process is blocked. As a result of allegedly pro-labor legislation and of the monopolistic power that labor unions enjoy, unemployed workers are not free to compete in the labor market by offering their services for less than the prevailing wage rates. Employers are not free to hire them. In the case of strikes, if unemployed workers attempted to obtain the jobs vacated by union strikers by offering to work for a lower wage, they often would be subjected to threats and physical violence at the hands of union members, with legal immunity for the union members, incidentally. These facts are as notorious as they are evaded in most current discussions of the unemployment problem, evaded particularly by government officials. C. When market conditions are such that producers whose labor costs have risen cannot raise the prices of the goods they sell, a curtailment of production results, as I have already indicated. And the general population accordingly suffers a loss of potential goods and services. Parenthetically, the notion that producers can absorb such wage increases by taking them out of profits without a detriment to future production, this notion is worse than economically naive. It is profits that make future production possible. The amount of profits that go not into investments but into the producer's personal consumption is negligible in the overall economic context. To the extent that market conditions do allow, producers whose labor costs have risen are obliged to raise the prices of their goods. Then workers in other industries find that their living costs have gone up, that they must now pay higher prices for the goods they purchase. Then they, in turn, demand a raise in their industries, which leads to new price rises, which leads to new wage increases, etc. Union leaders typically express indignation whenever prices are raised. The only prices they consider it moral to raise are the prices paid for labor, that is, wages. Non-unionized workers and the rest of the population generally face the same steady rise in their living costs. They are made to subsidize the unjustifiably high wages of union workers, and they are the unacknowledged victims of the union's social gains. And one observes the spectacle of bricklayers receiving two or even three times the salary of office workers and professors. It cannot be sufficiently emphasized that it is not unionism as such, but government controls and regulations which make this state of affairs possible. In a free, unregulated economy, in a market from which coercion is barred, no economic group can acquire the power so to victimize the rest of the population. The solution does not lie in new legislation directed against unions, but in the repeal of the legislation that made the present evil possible. The inability of unions to achieve real, widespread raises in wage rates, to raise the standard of living generally, is in part obscured by the phenomenon of inflation. As a consequence of the government's policy of deficit spending and credit expansion, the purchasing power of the monetary unit, the dollar, has diminished drastically across the years. Nominal wage rates have increased considerably more than real wage rates, that is, wages measured in terms of actual purchasing power. What has further served to obscure this issue is the fact that real wage rates have risen considerably since the start of the century. In spite of destructive and increasing governmental restraints on the freedom of production and trade, major advances in science, technology, and capital accumulation have been made and have raised the general standard of living. It should be added that these advances are less than would have occurred in a fully free economy, and as controls continue to tighten, such advances become slower and rarer. It is relevant to consider against what obstacles businessmen have had to fight and to go on producing. It is very relevant to remember this when one hears labor leaders proclaiming in indignant tones the worker's right to a larger share of the national product. To paraphrase John Galt, a larger share provided by whom? Blank out. Economic progress, like every other form of progress, has only one ultimate source, man's mind, and can exist only to the extent that man is free to translate his thought into action. Let anyone who believes that a high standard of living is the achievement of labor unions and government controls ask himself the following question. If one had a time machine and transported the United Labor Chieftains of America plus 3 million government bureaucrats back into the 10th century, would they be able to provide the medieval serf with electric light, refrigerators, automobiles, and television sets? When one grasps that they would not, one should identify who and what makes these things possible.